This is an interview by Heather Campbell with Major Charles Ellsworth Goodman on the 7th of November, 2008, at his home in North Saanich. So this is an interview with Major Charles Goodman on the 7th of November in his home in Sydney.
North Saanich.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Okay, so could we start off and maybe could you tell me briefly about your family and where you grew up?
Yes. My mother and father separated when I was 8 years old, and we were living in Toronto. Mm-hmm. It was not a happy marriage. My father was an alcoholic and an abuser. So his mother, my grandmother, gave my mother enough money so that we could get a train and go to New Brunswick, where her family lived. And so when I was 8 years old, we moved to New Brunswick and lived with my mother's mother, my grandmother, and two bachelor uncles mm-hmm. in this house. And so I started the school in New Brunswick in St. John in grade three, I guess it would have been. And it was in West St. John, and I had the normal boys' youth there, I guess. Mm-hmm. And my oldest uncle was a fisherman, mm-hmm. and I used to help him out going and fishing, and I just loved that because I could wear hip rubber boots, and I thought I looked very grown up. My other uncle was a veteran of World War I, and he had been a signaler in World War I, but in the infantry. Mm-hmm. And I thought, gee, that was really neat. And he taught me Morse code and how to read and send Morse code. Mm-hmm. And also in our school in grade 6, if you're 12 years old, you could join the cadets. And our school had a cadet corps. Mm-hmm. We even had a rifle range in the basement, so that you could fire 22 caliber rifles. And I became an expert shot. And my uncle also had a cottage or a hunting lodge out in the woods in New Brunswick. And I just loved going with him and shooting grouse or partridge and mm-hmm. eventually deer. Yes.
What were your reasons for joining the military? I think you mentioned...
Well, I guess for when the war broke out in 1939, I was 16 years old. No, 13 years old. And I thought, oh boy, I hope it lasts long enough for me to get into it. And I was in cadets then at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was an expert shot with the rifle. My uncle had served in the infantry, badly wounded in World War I. My father, who I didn't like, of course, had been in World War I, although he was never in action. And so I just thought it would be a neat thing if the war would last long enough for me to get into it. Mm-hmm. Plus that, we didn't have much money. My mother worked. One uncle, a fisherman, worked on the railway, so he had some money, but not much. And the other uncle only worked in the wintertime at the port in St. John. So I thought it would be neat if I could earn my own living mm-hmm. by being a soldier, mm-hmm. as well as the glamour of wearing a uniform and fighting in a war. Mm-hmm. I soon found out that after I was overseas there wasn't much glamour to it.
Yeah.
So it was patriotism and financial, I would think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I didn't miss my father because all I can remember of him is beating my mother and I. And I, instead of one father, I had two fathers by both my uncles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned the cadets when you were in school.
Yes.
Did you get much training before that helped you out when you...
Yes. In cadets, certainly marksmanship. Mm-hmm. How to parade and drill, and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. as well as the rank system and so on. So that when I was 15 years old, I joined the Reserve Army in the Signal Corps, and when I joined, I already knew how to salute and stand to attention, mm-hmm. the orders for parade square drill and the rank system, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
And then when you joined the Reserve Army, I presume you had training there as well?
Yes. More of the same, but also when I joined the Signal Corps, I could do Morse code, and we learned basic radio systems, because the active service force had all the good radios in them. Reserve Army just had what was left over, the old ones. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I learned to do that and to read light flashes in Morse. And I did have quite good training there. And after I'd been in there for a year, the hometown regiment, the St. John Fusiliers, was being posted out to the west coast of Vancouver Island, because a Japanese submarine had come up and shelled a lighthouse at Estevan Point on Vancouver Island. And that just frightened people on the west coast, thinking that a Japanese invasion could happen. And it could, because the Japanese had invaded the Aleutian Islands, and they were in the Aleutians. So the St. John Fusiliers, my hometown regiment, needed some signalers, and they asked the Signal Reserve Signal Corps, would anybody like to volunteer? Well, when you're 16, during the war, you had to get a registration card. And so I had one, and I changed the date of my birth so that it showed that I was 18, or 19, I guess, 19, and not 16. So I was really showing that I was 3 years older than I was. And I guess they really didn't care, because they didn't come to look at the documents in the Reserve Army. They just said, report for a medical. So I had a physical exam. I was 2 pounds underweight. The doctor said, that's all right, we'll fatten you up in the Army. And so I joined my hometown regiment, and about 2 or 3 months later, we came out to Nanaimo, and I already knew basic training sort of thing, and I already knew how to operate telephones and switchboards and radios and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I was in the signal platoon of the St. John Fusiliers, mm-hmm. although I was not in the signal corps as such, I was in the infantry.
And then how long were you out west?
Well, from Nanaimo, some of us went to Kiska, mm-hmm. but the Japanese had left Kiska Island, and so there was no fighting there. And the St. John Fusiliers only sent a company, so we came back early. Mm-hmm. We were only away 3 months, I guess. But some of the troops were up there quite a lengthy time. And when we came back, lo and behold, the battalion had moved from Nanaimo to Pat Bay. Do you know where the North Saanich Municipal Hall is on Wayne Road?
No.
It's right next to the airport. It's Wayne Road.
Oh, okay.
On the north side of the airport. Mm-hmm. And where the municipal hall was our army camp.
Oh.
And it was kind of neat, except that Sydney was very small, and all the girls were taken by the airmen who were training at the airport. And if we went into Victoria, there was no bars in those days in Victoria. Victoria was dry. So we had to go to Esquimalt to get a drink. And Esquimalt was full of sailors, and all the girls were taken by the sailors. So while I liked it there, the social life was nil.
Yeah.
And we were overjoyed when we were transferred from Pat Bay to New Westminster. Mm-hmm. And we were the only soldiers in town.
Ah, and what year was that?
That would be 1943. Okay. It's summer of 1943, after we came back from Kiskori. Just here a couple months. Mm-hmm. Went there. And that was really good. It was not so good from the soldiering point of view because there is no training area. Mm-hmm. So to do training was all done within the barracks. And if you're familiar with New Westminster, it's where the school is on 8th Street. That used to be the barracks. However, our task there was to do dawn patrols. And we'd go out to White Rock and Crescent Beach, and we'd go look at the beaches in the morning. We were dawn patrols to see if any Japanese had landed during the night or agents had been put ashore. Never found any.
Yeah.
But one of the courses I took there was how to ride a motorcycle, which was rather neat, I thought. Mm-hmm. First vehicle I ever drove, motorcycle. And after about 3 or 4 months there, I should say, the girls there were just lovely. And my best friend got married there, and I was best man at his wedding. And his name was Joe Legere, and he was from Port Eldon, New Brunswick. Mm-hmm. And so about 2 or 3 weeks after the wedding, we were sent up to Prince George, big training area there. And I think it was much like Nanaimo. There was more soldiers in the camp than there were civilians in town. So we did a lot of training there, and I learned to drive a Bren gun carrier. And we then came down to... Oh, are you familiar with the National Resources Mobilization Act? That was the call-up. People, Canadians, could be called up for service in the, mostly in the army. And you could not be sent overseas if you're a conscript. And we call them zombies because they couldn't think for themselves. So they filled in the units out here to bring them up to strength. So the ordinary strength of our infantry unit would be almost 1,000 people. If it was just the people who had volunteered to go overseas, probably only about half that number or less. So the rest were filled up by the NRMA people. But they couldn't be sent overseas. Well, it was early 1944, probably January and February, they decided they'd better get some reinforcements overseas because D-Day was going to happen in 1944. Mm-hmm. So we were moved, all the general service people were moved to Vernon. And we were put with some of my friends in the Rocky Mountain Rangers. They had taken out all the NRMA, or the zombies as we called them. They'd taken them all out, sent them someplace else, I don't know where, and filled them up with the general service. And we wore a little badge on our arm that said GS, General Service, which we were all very proud of. And so we just did a little bit of training because we were already trained in Vernon. Mostly it was the battle school where we did training under live fire. And then we went overseas. And we went to, we landed in Scotland, went overseas on the Empress of France. The Empress of Scotland. Overseas on the Empress of Scotland, which used to be the Empress of Japan. But the Empress of Scotland had been sunk. And we were at war with Japan, so they changed the name. It was a beautiful ship. And if the bunks, I think, were about 5 or 6 feet high, and if the person on the bottom turned over, everybody else had to turn over too because there wasn't much room between them. But I was detailed to work in the kitchen or the galley to help cook the meals, or actually we didn't do any cooking. I washed the dishes and the pots and pans. But it was good because I could get as much to eat as I wanted, and I didn't have to wait in line. The story was that you got in line for breakfast, and then you went and got in the line for lunch because there was Lord knows how many thousands of us aboard this troop ship. And so that's what you did all day long, was stand in line to eat. So working in the galley did have its advantages. Mm-hmm. My free time, I learned to play bridge. Somebody needed a fourth for bridge, and my friends taught me. And we landed in Scotland in, about April 1944, and went to a camp in Yorkshire. And this was a toughening camp. We did a route march of somewhere between 10 and 25 miles almost every day to toughen us up because D-Day was coming. And one day, the sky was full of airplanes, and listened to the radio, D-Day had happened, the 6th of June. So we were, those of us who had good training, were sent off to Aldershot in southern England. And unfortunately, we were lined up in alphabetical order, and A to B or C were sent off to this unit and so on. So my best friend, Joe Legere, the Elves, was sent to another regiment, and I was sent to the South Saskatchewan regiment. So we went to France about the 6th of July, and we were reinforcements, and we just traveled at one of the rear echelons, and after they had their first battle and they lost quite a few people, then we went up and replaced them. So they had what we call first-line reinforcements.
Mm-hmm. Going back to your time in England, how long were you in England before you...
About 3 months, I guess. Three or 4 months.
And did you have substantial additional training? You mentioned that there were marches that you went on.
Toughening up training, I would say.
Yeah.
We also did live firing and on other weapons, such as the anti-tank rifle and the Piat anti-tank gun. Did some demolitions, learned how to arm and de-arm mines, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Yeah. And then did you find that come in useful when you were in France? Did you apply?
Well, some of it, yes. Mm-hmm. Laying mines. And I did actually fire a Piat at a German tank at one time. I could have done that anyway.
Yeah. Yes. What kind of equipment and provisions did they supply you with to go over there?
Well, we were mostly equipped with a rifle. Mm-hmm. And when we got to France, remember, this was D plus 30 when we went over, so the forward troops had gone far away, and they were up near Caen. Mm-hmm. And we weren't expected to go into battle for a couple of weeks. And we were issued with ammunition to carry, and I had a rifle. And we also were given battle armor. And it was a plate that came here and down below the waist, and one on the back. Mm-hmm. But it was very uncomfortable to wear, and most people threw it away. And what else did we have? Oh, we were given a emergency ration, which we usually carried in our hip pocket, and it was a block of chocolate in a tin can, and you were only supposed to open it upon orders. We had a shell dressing which we wore inside the netting, camouflage net in our helmet. And that was for big wounds. And then a little pocket on our battle dress, trouser leg, we carried a smaller dressing. and it was for smaller ones. Mm-hmm. I guess that would be about it. Mm-hmm. We were waiting at the B echelon of the South Saskatchewan Regiment. We were bombed a couple times, and we were just sleeping on the ground. We had one blanket and your great coat, and that was it, and a ground sheet. Oh, and a gas cape, which was rolled up, carried on our web equipment. And so it wasn't at all comfortable. It wasn't supposed to be comfortable. But we slept alongside of a big shell hole that had probably been made by our own Air Force. So during the nights, we were subjected to sporadic bombing and so on. Mm-hmm. And I was very surprised to see a friend of mine, who I thought was a pretty brave person, was really frightened. Mm-hmm. Really frightened out of his wits. I thought it was incredible to sit there and watch the searchlights and the tracers going up in the sky.
So you weren't scared or afraid at all at that point?
No.
No?
No.
When was the first time you were sent in action after you were there?
That would be the 21st of July. Mm-hmm. That was after the first battle. So we replaced the people who had been killed or wounded in the first battle. And that would be on the east side, southeast side of Caen. And that was frightening. The shelling was very heavy. You did not dare move during the daytime or you'd be shot at. It was much like, I should imagine, some of the First World War, where you're in a trench. But we weren't in the big, long line of trenches. We were called a slit trench. The Americans called them foxholes. This was a slit trench. And usually two men were in it. And big enough for one man to lie down while the other man crouched there and could look up over the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I heard one story somewhere that you didn't put your head above.
Not around there.
Not in the day.
Not in the daytime.
No.
So you did everything in that little mm-hmm. 6-foot slit trench.
Yeah.
Our food would come up after dark. And that was it. That's did you for the next day. But there was a lot of patrolling, and that was kind of scary. We would be probably on patrol once a week, and a couple times we went out and laid mines, anti-tank mines, mm-hmm. to deter the Germans from crossing the open fields that were in front of us. At our back was a farmer's fence made of rocks that he had dug up out of his freight fields and so on. Mm-hmm. And the fields were wheat fields. Much of it had been burned from the shells. And from the first battles there, the stink of rotting corpses was something no one who was there will ever forget. Mm-hmm. The smell of the dead bodies, mm-hmm. Canadian and German.
Yeah. And these patrols, these all happened that night, I presume?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And so when you were over there, did you have any communication with people back home at all, or?
Yes. The mail system worked quite well. Mm-hmm. And we had airmail forms. Mm-hmm. And that already had stamps on them, I think. I don't remember. But anyway, you could use these and write and just fold them up. And all the mail had to be censored. So they were given to the officer, and he would read them to make sure there are no military secrets mm-hmm. going out, or they didn't reflect too badly on the morale of the troops, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And they went back, and then we got letters back again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And did that happen fairly frequently?
I don't remember. I wrote quite often, I think.
Yeah.
And I'd been there a couple weeks, and I was sent to have a course on a new type of radio. I was not employed as a signaler at this time, mm-hmm. but I was qualified. And so there's a radio new to us. who had just come from Canada, and it was a 2-day course. And so we learned to operate this radio, which was called a number 18 set. And lo and behold, my friend Joe Legere was on this course. So we shared a split trench for the 2 nights that we were there. Mm-hmm. And he went back, and the next week he was killed. He received a burst of machine gun bullets in his chest and died. Yeah. Still hurts.
Yeah. So then, after that training, did you...
No, I was still an infantryman. Uh-huh. And we left Caen and went to a place called Verrières. Mm-hmm. And it was a real hot spot. It was called, we called it Hell's Fire Corner, under almost continuous shelling and direct fire of German tanks. And I saw an incredible thing there. One of our anti-tank gunners knocked out 3 tanks with 3 rounds. 1 round per tank.
Wow.
And that deterred the Germans from crossing that field of fire.
I would imagine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then on the 8th of August was the largest artillery barrage since El Alamein or World War I. And the Allies burst out of the front and started towards Falaise. And it was an incredible sight. And our first objective was a place called Roquencourt, R-O-C-Q-U-E-N-C-O-U-R-T. And that's the first place where I saw a living German. Mm-hmm. And my platoon captured 18 of them who were in a bunker hiding. And I was detailed to take them back to the prisoner of war cage, which was run by our military police. And as we were walking back guarding these things, probably a corporal and 2 or 3 other of us, there was the whole Canadian 4th Division lined up to go in for their first battle. And as I was going by a Canadian tank, this guy leaned out and said, "Holy smoke, look at that kid there. How old do you suppose he is?" And I thought he was pointing to one of the Germans. He's pointing to me. I was a veteran by this time. He almost got himself shot. And then from there, we tried to close the Falaise pocket. And we were quite successful in that. We got a lot of prisoners between their Falaise. And my battalion was one of the first troops to get into the town of Falaise itself. And I've been back to Falaise many times. The people there are very nice. The mayor is now a friend of mine. And I have friends there that I correspond with regularly from my visits back there.
Yeah. Did you encounter many civilians at the time?
No. We never saw any civilians. Mm-hmm. They were evacuated from Caen or else they're hiding in their basements. And the fighting in Falaise was much of, from house to house. And so the civilians had fled.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever meet civilians at any time, sort of, when you were over in France? Beyond Falaise, when you...
Very few, yeah. Very few. Most of them fled when the fighting got close to them, oh. Which is a good thing to do.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And then from Falaise, we went through a number of villages, and one, a place called Brion, was very interesting. A small town, and I've been back there a couple of times. I'll show you some pictures of it later. Okay. There used to be some mines there. And the people hid in the mine shafts. And when Nancy and I were there in 2004, they held a service, memorial service, in the mine shaft. It was very interesting. And that town was quite interesting. We didn't have a battle in the town, but we had a battle getting into the town. Mm-hmm. And, no, it wasn't a signal yet. It was still... Mm-hmm. Still... Rifleman. But the battle getting in there was just another battle, and we caught some prisoners and we chased the Germans away. got in the town, and there were a few civilians there. From there, we eventually got to a place which nobody has ever heard of called Forêt de la Lande, the Long Forest. And the casualties there were heavier than most of the battles in the First War. When that battle ended in my battalion, the South Saskatchewan Regiment, in my company, B Company, I think there was one officer and 10 men. 10. There should have been 120. And 5 officers.
Wow. And you were one of those men?
I was one of those men. And it was a tremendous battle, which is a story in itself. And then from there, we finally crossed the Seine River into Rouen. That's when we saw the civilians. Rouen, quite a large town, you know, the home of Joan of Arc and the huge cathedral. And the people were out on the streets waving, shouting, kissing, passing drinks of wine or cider or something like that. And we were billeted, the Germans had withdrawn, we were billeted in a school. Outside the gates of the school, the French stayed there all night singing La Marseillaise. It was really moving. Well, the 2nd Division, which I was part of course took part in the raid in Dieppe in 1942. Mm-hmm. So the powers that be thought it would be a good thing if the 2nd Division went to Dieppe and had a parade, because the Germans had left there. And they thought it would be a great thing. We'd have time to reorganize, get new reinforcements in, and so on. So instead of following a long line east, we turned north and went to Dieppe. And most of us weren't very happy about it because we had to shine our boots, shine our brass. And the idea was you didn't want your brass to shine because it would glint in the sunlight and make you a target. And so anyway, we did go to Dieppe, and we did get reinforcements there, and we had this big parade, mm-hmm. and that's when I became a signaler. Mm-hmm. So they had a lot of casualties in the signal platoon, mm-hmm. so they took the qualified people, and I became a signaler, but it was with the same company, with the same B company. Mm-hmm. But now, I was carrying a radio on my back, an 18 set, which weighed about 35 pounds, plus my weapon. Well, I traded my rifle for a Sten gun, which is a small submachine gun. Mm-hmm. And now I sat in when the company commander, who was supposed to be a major, quite often it was a captain, and occasionally only a lieutenant, because they tended to get themselves killed or wounded. I knew what was going on because I could listen to all the radio chat, mm-hmm. and the company commander, when he briefed his platoon commanders, I was sitting there with the radio. So I found that very interesting.
Yeah. Going back to when you were in, you called it the Long Forest?
Forêt de la Lande.
Forêt de la Lande.
L-O-N-D-E.
You said there was that was sort of a story in itself. Would you care to go into that at all?
Or? Well, we were very short of people even then because we lost a lot of people along the way.
Going into it, you mean?
Yeah, coming to the forest. And we got up into the forest itself, and the Germans were holding it in force because they wanted to stop us from stopping them from taking their troops to the east bank of the Seine River. The ground there was very high, and when we got up there, you could look out and you see columns of Germans withdrawing east. And our aircraft would come over and bomb them, and as soon as they were out of the aircraft were gone, they would start up back on the roads again. we brought up the heavy machine gun, not heavy, the medium machine guns, the Vickers guns, and they could fire a 303 bullet a long distance away. And so they were providing harassing fire on these roads. And it was great fun for us to stand there and watch these. The bullets would fly away, and of course the Germans couldn't hear them because we were on one side of the river, they and the other, a couple miles away. And suddenly these bullets would start falling on the road and they would scatter. And as soon as they got back on the road, they would fire again. So it must have been just like rain falling on them, except it would be deadly rain. And a neat little story, which I've often told. I guess we didn't have an officer, because the company sergeant major sent a corporal and myself and another man on a patrol to find where the German lines were in the forest. This was at night. So off we went with the corporal leading. He knew where to go, we hoped. And we came to a paved road. And we could hear a horse coming up the road. So the corporal stood behind us, and me and one side of the road, and the other guy on the other side. And up came three Germans with a horse and wagon. And it was a mobile kitchen, field kitchen. So they were coming out to give food to the German troops. We had gone right through their lines, the German lines. So we're behind the German lines. So very quietly we stopped them and disarmed them. And I thought, oh boy, we got some prisoners. You know, our intelligence will be happy to hear that. Mm-hmm. And so we started back with them. And the other soldier I was with, who I didn't know, said, Corporal, we can't leave that horse tied up to that wagon. We've got to turn him loose. So the corporal, who must have been a farm boy too, turned around, and the Germans helped us undo the horse from the harness. And then we gave the horse a slap on the rump, and he went clomp, clomp down the road. We turned around and went back. And Sergeant Major was just ecstatic that we had three prisoners. And somebody took them back to battalion headquarters to be interrogated. But we stayed in the slit trenches all night. And it was near a castle. And we could hear that clonk, clonk, clonk of that horse going back and forth down the road looking for a friend. The castle, incidentally, is called the Castillo Robert Diabla, the castle of Robert the Devil. And it was an old Viking castle. And I'd forgotten the Vikings had been in that part of France. And the castle overlooked the Seine River there, and they had a toll gate on the river. So the Vikings charged a toll to all boats coming up or going down the Seine River from there.
Wow.
I've been back to that castle many times since. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. It's now a museum.
Oh, okay. So I was going to ask you if you could go in it, but I guess if it's a museum, you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then after that you were, so back to Dieppe, and then mm-hmm. that was, I guess, coming up near the end of the war by this point.
Oh, no, that was in late August or early September, I've forgotten.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so we still had 6-7 months of war to go through yet.
Mm-hmm.
And from... And from Dieppe, we moved up to the French-Belgian border. Mm-hmm. And we did a very wet, long march. And we ended up and liberated the small Belgian town of Nieuport, right on the channel. And we got into the town all right, but there was a lot of sand dunes along the shore there. And those sand dunes all had concrete bunkers in them facing out towards the English Channel, because that's where the Germans thought the landings would take place. So that was part of what they called the West Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a heck of a time digging the Germans out of those things. We lost a lot of people. We'd go up every night to try to get them out of those bunkers. And they finally surrendered. We were going to bring in the heavy bombers to get them out. So then we moved back towards France. And there's a small town, Redoun's Plage. And my company commander at that time was a Captain Sharp. And I was following right behind him where the signaler is supposed to be. Now, there's two signalers. One signaler guards the other guy because you have those earphones on. You can't hear anything or very much. And you can't, so you're supposed to be paying attention to the company commander, so you're not looking to see somebody shooting at you. So the other signaler is sort of rides shotgun for the guy who has the radio. And we had trade over every couple hours. For some reason or another, we didn't have another signaler this day. And as we started off, I had dysentery. That's the next thing to dysentery. The trots. And I told the company commander, Captain Sharp, I said, I got to stop, I got to go. He said, go then. So I sat just to the side of the road with the company marching by, straggling by. I pulled down my trousers and went. And you can imagine the comments of the troops walking by. Scared shitless, eh, Goodman? Anyway, I did my business, called up my trousers, and scurried ahead to try to catch up to company headquarters. I got up, just let me explain. Company headquarters, there'd be the company commander and the signaler right behind him. Then the other signaler. Mm-hmm. And then a runner. And the runner would take messages to the platoons if the company commander wanted to send a message to the platoon. Mm-hmm. And then there would be the stretcher bearers. So if somebody's wounded, the two stretcher bearers would go and carry the guy out someplace. But I wasn't in the right place, and we only had the one signaler that day for some reason or another. And so by the time I caught up to company headquarters, I was mixed in with the stretcher bearers. The company commander stepped in a mine. Captain Sharp was killed instantly. He was from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. The company sergeant major was badly wounded, and I think he died in hospital. The batman was hit in the groin, and he was from New Brunswick, but he survived, but he could never have any children. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I didn't get a scratch.
Yeah.
If I hadn't had diarrhea that day, I wouldn't have made it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, that place was littered with mines, and these are jumping mines. And when you stepped on them, the drill was you left your foot on it. It would blow your foot off, but it would kill you.
Mm-hmm.
If you stuck your foot off, the thing would jump up in the air about 3 feet and then explode. So it scattered shrapnel all over the place. And so the company commander probably didn't realize what he had done. He set his mind off. Bang. Lost it. Well, the place was full of mines, and there didn't seem to be any Germans in the village. So we moved further back and just crossed back into the French border again. And again, we were busy picking Germans out of the big bunkers. Mm-hmm. With guns that faced the channel.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first company commander I lost. A Major Williams, who incidentally is from Victoria. And if you look at the newspaper next week, you'll see the story of how Major Williams met his end, took over. And we moved back into Belgium again. And our job was to cross the Antwerp-Turnhout Canal. and we had a heck of a big battle there. Mm-hmm. And Major Williams was killed in that battle. And he saved my life. I got up to follow him to be at his back with the radio. And he said, no, you stay here. And I stayed there. You must realize this radio was very large and it had a 6-foot antenna going up in the air. So it was like a target for people to shoot at. And so he didn't want to have a moving target following him as he went forward to see one of those platoon commanders.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So then after...
So after that, we then moved further up into Belgium and then into Holland. Mm-hmm. And the thing that we were trying to do then was to clear the Scheldt estuary. This is the larger tactic. Mm-hmm. Clear the Scheldt estuary so that ships could come into the port of Antwerp so that they wouldn't have to drive 10 hours back to the beaches to get the supplies coming in, mm-hmm. and then 10 hours back again. Mm-hmm. And that was after Operation Market Garden, or during it, where the paratroops landed in Eindhoven, Nijmegen, and Arnhem. We saw them going over, but of course we didn't take part in those battles. So we went into Holland, and we had a couple of small battles at Dutch towns. And on the 24th of October, myself and another signaler just put the radio on. I think he had the radio on. That was going to be his protection. So we started off that morning, and the company commander and people were just forming up in this Dutch farmhouse, and a German shell came flying over and he hit the tree in the back of the yard, exploded, and the company commander lost the lobe off his ear. The other signaler was badly wounded, and I had a piece across my brow and in my cheek and in my leg. A piece of my leg was probably about that long. It was like a pencil or a spike that just went in first into my leg.
Yeah.
So I couldn't walk. So I was evacuated and went to the Canadian Field Hospital just outside of Antwerp, a place called Merksem. But it wasn't a serious wound. And after about 10 days, I was discharged from the hospital and went back to my town. And by that time, they were about two-thirds of the way up the Scheldt Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And the Germans surrendered maybe 4 or 5 days later in that area. Mm-hmm. Well, we were there maybe for another week regrouping. And then we were moved up into Holland to Nijmegen. And we took over from the paratroops who had captured the big bridge at Nijmegen and the high ground in the Reichswald Forest. And that would have been November, and we were there until the 8th of February. And I guess it was much like the first war. We lived in bunkers. We didn't have lines of trenches, but we had some trenches that were lines that were within sight of the enemy. And we spent the winter in that Reichswald Forest, patrolling, mm-hmm. raids. A raid is different than a patrol, and the raid would be company or more strength. And then, so we'd have a big barrage of artillery, and then we'd raid the German lines, try to capture prisoners, or destroy strong points.
Mm-hmm. How was morale at that point after all that?
Morale there was pretty good. In fact, I don't ever remember the morale in my company ever being bad. Mm-hmm. Some people were frightened. There were a few who shot themselves in order to get out of the fighting. Not many. Shell shock. A few, again, not many. What do they call shell shock now? Well, there's some fancy name for it.
Yeah, post-traumatic.
That's it.
Yeah.
Stress syndrome.
Yeah.
And but not many. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it affected me. By this time, I was a veteran, of course. Still only 18 years old. I was still a year young to be overseas. Mm-hmm. You weren't supposed to go overseas until you're 19. And I had my 19th birthday in the front line in the Reichswald Forest. So now I was finally old enough to go overseas, they couldn't send me home.
Did they ever find out that you weren't old enough?
No.
No.
And so then, I think it was 3 days after my birthday, on the 8th of February, there was a tremendous big barrage reminding me of the one that we had outside of Caen. And we burst out of there through the Reichswald Forest. And we had some big battles in the Hochwald Forest, in a small town called Exanten on the west bank of the Rhine, crossed the Rhine at Emden, and then turned north and went back into Holland again. And the big thing there was we liberated a Dutch concentration camp called Westerbork in Holland. Now, it was not like the death camps. It was a concentration camp, and the Dutch SS and the German SS picked up Dutch Jews and put them in this camp, and then they sorted them out. And so that if you were male and strong enough to work, then you went to Dachau and went off to a work camp. Mm-hmm. If you weren't deemed fit enough to work, then you went to Dachau and you were killed. If you thought you might be able to work someday, then you went to Bergen-Belsen. And that's where the two Frank sisters went. What's her name? Anne Frank. Anne Frank and her sister went to Bergen-Belsen. Their father and mother went to Dachau. And the father survived because he was working. The mother didn't survive because she was useless to work, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so we liberated that camp. And then we went north to Groningen, and that was the largest Dutch town that we had liberated. And then we turned east again and entered Germany. And by that time, I guess it was just before we went to Groningen and around the concentration camp, they promoted the other Singler with B Company, Lance Corporal. And I thought I should be the Lance Corporal. But it didn't. So I had my nose was out of joint, and I got a transfer to the carrier platoon. My excuse was that my feet were hurting after walking all the way from the beaches in Normandy. And so I went to the carrier platoon as a Singler. And they were Bren Gun carriers. Are you familiar with that? It's a small, lightly armored vehicle. Mm-hmm. And it was used mostly for reconnaissance or carrying ammunition or food forward to the fighting troops. And we went into Groningen, liberated Groningen, got quite a few prisoners out of there. It was the first place that I saw that how starving the Dutch were. A German horse had been killed from shell fire, and its carcass was in the main square of town. As soon as the firing died down and the Germans withdrew or had been killed or captured, the Dutch rushed out of their houses, and they butchered that horse until there's nothing left but the hoofs. I was quite amazed. Mm-hmm. Head, the whole works was gone. Most of the innards, too.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized these people are starving.
Yeah.
And then from Groningen, we went into Germany. And just on the outskirts of the large town of Oldenburg, there was little resistance. And the commanding officer said, we'll send the carrier platoon forward to scout. So I was in the carrier with the platoon commander, Lieutenant Blake, and we came up to a small farm, and I was not on the radio. I was riding shotgun, so I had a rifle. It was an automatic rifle, which I'd taken from a German. And so I didn't have the Sten gun, which was very unreliable. But anyhow, I was sighting on a German that I saw run out of the barn, but then I thought he was a civilian, so I didn't shoot. And just then we hit a mine. Lieutenant Blake was killed. The driver, who was next to him, in the forward part of the carrier, lost his leg and arm on that side, died on the way to hospital. The other signaler, the radio, flew up and hit him in the face. I understand he died later. And I was blown out without a scratch. I was blown unconscious. And I think I saw trees under me when I was blown out. Mm-hmm. But when I came to, somebody's giving me a drink of rum. My old company came by with Major Lee, my company commander. And he said, "Chick, were you in that carrier?" And I said, "Yes, sir. Can I come back to B Company?" He said, "Yeah, fall in." So I came back to B Company, and the war ended about 2 weeks later. Mm-hmm. So I ended the war with the same company I started with.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And then you mentioned that you stayed on in Holland after the war?
Yes. We were given our choice, and people were given a number of points. By the time, so many points for the time that you're in the army, mm-hmm. so many points for the time that you're overseas, so many points for time overseas in action. And so I had enough points to go home, but I hadn't seen much of England, hadn't seen much of Europe, actually, just walking from the beaches to Germany.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I'd like to stay over here for a while. I'm single, there's not much to go home for. And so I volunteered for the occupation force. And there's going to be a complete division in the occupation force, and it's going to be the 3rd Division, composed of units that had actually landed in France on D-Day. And so they took all the volunteers from, and the people who didn't have enough points to go home, put them in all these units. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in a New Brunswick unit, the North Shore Regiment. And we spent a year in the occupation force. Now, if you want to write a book, no one has written a book yet about the occupation force.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting. We moved into Germany to a place called Aurich, A-U-R-I-C-H. And most of the troops were in the German barracks. Are you familiar with the controversy about the strategic bombing of Germany, how they changed the signs of the National War Museum and so on?
I may have heard something briefly about it, but...
Well, when you talk to a combat infantryman, like I and my buddies were and are, that barracks didn't have a scratch on it. Why did they go bomb all the German cities like Emden and so on? Or flatten them. They didn't bomb the German barracks. Think of the soldiers they might have been able to kill in there. They wouldn't have been able to fight us. Anyway, we then moved north to Wilhelmshaven, which was a German port, is a German port. And a lot of German naval vessels were in there. We took over the vessels to make sure that the Germans didn't scuttle them, because the Allies, of course, still had to fight Japan, and these ships could be... The ship that we were guarding, my company, was the Prince Eugen. German ship Prince Eugen, a big battleship. And so we had troops on it night and day. And the German sailors were on there as well. But we had to make sure that they didn't scuttle the ship. And the signalers were up on the bridge. and we had a radio there and a telephone so that we could call for reinforcements or whatever if need be. So I was up there for a couple of months before the ship was given to the Americans, and the Germans on it were overjoyed. They were going to go to the United States because, of course, all the dials on the ship were in German, and all the instructions for running this thing were in German. So the Americans took the ship with the crew. They were overjoyed the Germans were going to America. The ship had an interesting history after that. During the atom bomb trials, it was taken to Bikini, and it didn't sink after the atom bomb. So they took it to Iwetok, and the H-bomb sank it there. The Russians got some ships, and the Germans refused to go with them. But I think they forced them to go. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see if they ever got back from Russia.
Yeah.
And Britain got some of the ships and so on. I don't think Canada wanted any. And we also would do non-patrols around some villages. And we'd surround these villages, and the officers and some of the NCOs would go into the village, and they had books, and they were looking for war criminals. I don't think we found any, but that was one of the jobs that we're doing. And again, it was a beautiful barracks we were in at a place called Sangwarden, just outside of Wilhelmshaven. Not a scratch on it. Why did they bomb all those guys that were living in that barracks instead of bombing Dresden? They're useless bombing. Anyway, that's my story. Well, we were there, and of course, many of us, like myself, were run down. And that winter, around Christmas time, 1945, I got pneumonia and I was in the hospital over Christmas and New Year's. And I got out and I was sent on leave to England to recuperate. And I ended up in the military hospital in England with a relapse of pneumonia. Mm-hmm. So I spent a couple, 3 weeks in England in hospital. Finally got back to my unit. And we came back to Canada in May 1946. Mm-hmm. On the Île-de-France luxury liner, except that it had probably about 4,000 soldiers on it and about 2,000 war brides and their children. I wasn't lucky enough to work in the kitchen on this one, so I spent most of my time lined up for food.
You got the other side of it.
That's right, yeah. So then I got back home. I decided I would stay in the Army, make it a career, and that's when I declared my true age then. By that time, I was 1945, I was 19, and no, it was 1946, I was 20. I had my 19th birthday in a hospital in Germany, I think, pneumonia. And so I remember hearing, and I transferred to the Signal Corps. I said, the infantry is no place to be in peacetime. No place to be in wartime either, but not in peacetime. And so I transferred to the Signal Corps. And I heard when I declared my true age and I had to sign the papers to join the regular force, I heard the company commander, whatever he was, the commanding officers say, he said, Christ, how old is he? He's not old enough to go overseas yet, is he? Of course, I had more medals because these guys had never been out of Canada during the war. I had more medals than any of them did. So then I stayed for 34 years service.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, is there anything else that you want to add at all?
I don't know, Heather.
No?
It's your interview. You ask the questions.
Well, I think that pretty much sums up all the questions that I've got here. So Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And, yeah.
Thank you for coming.
I'm going to.
And that's his grave marker. He died early. And this is a two German paratroops. And this says, a Belgian man and woman murdered by the English. So it looks like the house has been demolished. Maybe they are hit by a bomb.
Yeah.
And how would you like to stand up there in the window?
Oh, wow. I guess you don't know who that is up there.
No, I do. I know. It's interesting, windmills. We tend to think of the Dutch windmill. This windmill, instead of turning the top so the blades face the wind, you turn the whole top. This, from there, see, there's
the whole turntable. The whole thing. Yeah. Wow.
And that was the German labor corps. Mm-hmm. Because Germany was forbidden to rearm, when the Nazis took over, they started this labor corps. And so they are drilled and trained as soldiers, but they carried shovels. See, they have a shovel over their shoulder?
Yeah.
That's a German airplane.
I need to go to the grocery store. Do we want to go?
What's that there?
Do you want to go for coffee with me when I go to the grocery store? Shall I go ahead?
You go ahead. We've got to go to Victoria yet.
Okay, you're going to take Heather. Good.
No, I'm not going to take Heather. She's going to catch the bus.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, good. Do you live in Victoria? I mean, are you from Victoria?
Originally, no. I'm from Tawasin, but I go to UVic, so I've been there for the last, I think, 3.5 years.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Good. So, let's see. Okay, well, I'll do that then. You're right. Time is fast.
Yeah, time's flitting. Now, we're going to the symphony tonight.
Oh, wonderful.
And on the back of that says, after a hard landing in German. See the colors meant at the top?
Oh.
So there's the German air crew there.
That's a good one. I'm going to take a picture of that, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
There. And propeller.
Lots of your report.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I'll send you both a copy.
Oh, that'd be great. Good. Bye.
This is a memorial type of.
Yeah. Yeah. The Horst Wessel song is the marching song for the German, named after Horst Wessel.
And that's what this is? No.
No. I forgot what that is. Oh, I think that's who that funeral was.
Oh,
I think I'd forgotten this was the name.
Yeah.
I think that's who it was.
No, I guess it's life there. Oh. And these are all pictures you found on the
bodies. Or in the kit.
Yeah. Wow. It's amazing.
Yeah. And as I say, I gave them to the museum.
Yeah. Major Goodman also mentioned that there were Polish troops that helped liberate Holland along with the Canadians. And then he mentioned that it was based on the fact that when they captured Germans, they called for all the Polish people that were in the army, because of course they would have conscripted Polish people into the German army as well. And so they had the choice of being going to a prisoner of war camp or staying in joining the Polish army. And many of them joined the Polish army.
He also mentioned, he was showing me pictures, he also mentioned that the Germans used horses quite often for pulling artillery and transporting people in wagons and things like that.